Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. It's hard to imagine that any technological breakthrough in history has had quite the impact on communication as the Internet, but in fact there have been some, the printing press, for example, and the telegraph. In today's show, we will talk to Tom Standage, author of The Victorian Internet, about the telegraph. But before we get to that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1865, Englishman William Booth founded in London what would eventually come to be known worldwide as the Salvation Army. Born to a humble family in 1829, Booth's father died when he was 13 years old, leaving him to financially support his mother and siblings. At 15, disillusioned with the capitalist atmosphere of Victorian London, Booth underwent a dramatic Christian conversion and became determined to apply the lofty ideals of his Christianity to helping the forgotten and destitute people of London. Opening a mission at Whitechapel in 1865, Booth offered a more immediate and practical salvation, hence Salvation Army, to homeless people, namely clothes, medicine, food, and shelter. And for their efforts, Booth and his ranks of aid workers were loved symbols of hope and survival for millions, while at the same time they were vilified as a serious threat to an industrialized, established English society. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, President Thomas Jefferson's apparent affair with a former slave, Sally Hemings, was the source of still more controversy at a recent meeting of the Monticello Association. The group, which today consists of about 700 descendants of President Jefferson and his wife Martha, meets every year at Jefferson's home in Virginia to converse, eat, and celebrate. However, this year's meeting marked the first time that African Americans were invited. These people, of course, believe they are descendants of Jefferson and Hemings' affair over 200 years ago. Many white progeny were uneasy with sharing their family home with the Hemings children. Others were quite comfortable with the new relations. Still, many black members were shaken by the bigotry and racism present at the dinner. One descendant, Deborah Edwards, commented, "In days gone by, they wore wamsutta sheets and pillowcases. Today, they wear suits." And after 75 years of guessing games by mountain climbers, scientists, and historians, the body of Englishman George Mallory was found on Mount Everest. For years, Mallory's fate was unknown since his third and final attempt to reach the peak of the mountain in June 1924. Known by his family and friends as Sir Galahad, Mallory was the premier mountain climber in Europe at the time of his death. Throughout his three attempts to scale the six-mile-high mountain, Mallory lost 12 men, including Andrew Irvin, the man with him on that fateful day. While Mallory's body, frozen and preserved, was found at about 27,000 feet, Irvin's was relatively lower, indicating a violent fall that severed the rope connecting them. The Mallory and Irvin research expedition hopes to uncover other clues that will answer the ultimate question, did Mallory or Irvin reach the summit of Mount Everest? You're listening to Talking History. It unleashed the greatest revolution in communication since the development of the printing press. No, we're not talking about the Internet, but the telegraph. For thousands of years, people had communicated across distances only as quickly as the fastest ship or horse could travel. Then, over the course of three decades in the mid-1800s, a few extraordinary pioneers achieved a breakthrough in communications that nullified distance and shrank the world quicker and further than ever before, or perhaps ever since. The invention of the telegraph and its impact on the world is a fascinating story, and that story has been told well in a new book, The Victorian Internet, The Remarkable Story of the Telegraph and the 19th Century's Online Pioneers, by Tom Standage. Tom Standage is a journalist who has covered science and technology for newspapers and magazines such as The Guardian, The Independent, and The Daily Telegraph. Currently, he's a science writer for The Economist. And Mr. Standage joins us today by telephone from his home in Greenwich, England. Welcome, Tom, and congratulations on the success of your new book.
Thank you very much.
Let's get to it. Why did you choose this title for a book on the telegraph?
Well, the Victorian Internet, I thought, really summed up the what the telegraph was from a modern point of view. I mean, it sounds like a a contradiction in terms, the idea that the Victorians could have had an internet, something that we think of as a quintessentially modern thing. But really the whole point of the book is that they did, and that all of the things that we think happened for the first time in the last few years with the internet actually happened in the 19th century with the telegraph. So the title sort of sums that up and invites the reader to say, an internet in the Victorian era, is that really possible? And, you know, and to open the book, I hope.
Well, you certainly draw some good parallels in the book, but let me ask you, just follow up on that a bit. Did you know that going into the research?
Yes. I originally read an article. When I was at the Daily Telegraph, I thought I would do a story on the telegraph, and originally I thought I would do a sort of comparison of the telegraph network of the world, which I dimly knew existed. I'd heard about things like the laying of the transatlantic cable, and I thought that what I would end up doing was contrasting the sort of slow, awful network of the telegraph with the sort of wonders of the internet. But in fact, instead of contrast, I found parallels. And the more I dug, the more of these parallels I found. So I wrote a 2,000-word article about it, but in fact I realized I had enough for a short book. So that was really where the idea for the book came from.
Well, I want to explore some of those parallels. So let's just step back for a moment and briefly summarize for us what led to the invention of the telegraph. Who were the major figures involved?
Well, for me, it all starts in the middle of the 18th century when people start experimenting with electricity. My particular favorite tale, which appears in the book, concerns a group of Carthusian monks at the Grand Convent in Paris. And one day they're all lined up in the courtyard of the convent, and they're all given a piece of wire, which they hold, and they're given one to hold in each hand. And this connects them all together in a line about a mile long. And they're not quite sure why they're doing this. And then the Abbé Nollet, who is a French scientist, comes along, and he has a strange-looking device in his hand. And in fact, it's a primitive battery, which he connects to one end of the line. And this gives all the monks a powerful electric shock. And they all say, ouch, at the same time and sort of jump in the air. And this sounds very silly, but it's in fact extremely significant because this showed two things. It showed you could send electricity over a distance of a mile, potentially further. And it also showed that it traveled that kind of distance instantly, as far as anyone could tell. And so once people started doing these kinds of early experiments with electricity, they realized that if they could harness it in the right way, they could potentially build a communications device that would enable them to send information very long distances very quickly. So that was really how it started. Now, it then took almost another century for this to be perfected. An awful lot of people tried to build telegraphs, and none of them ever really managed to stage convincing demonstrations or make them reliable enough. And of course, the person we associate with the telegraph today is Samuel Morse. And Morse wasn't really, you know, any greater scientist or an inventor than any of the other people who had a go at building telegraphs. The quality that he had that meant that we remember him and not anyone else was that he was unbelievably stubborn. And he absolutely insisted that his device was going to change the world and so on. And he just kept on banging until people listened to him. And ultimately, of course, he was proved right.
So this is one of those inventions that come up in history where so many people contributed to it, but Morse more or less gets the credit because he was perhaps the most persistent in marketing.
Yes, that's pretty much right. I mean, if you look at the beginning of any invention, there are almost always lots and lots of different people working towards the same thing at the same time. And Morse in later life had to defend his right to claim to be the inventor of the telegraph in court. And ultimately it was upheld because other people had done it, but they hadn't really put all the pieces together in the way that he had and actually gone out and shown people that it was a practical possibility.
Well, tell us about the impact of this invention on any number of things, perhaps starting with international relations or diplomacy.
Well, the reaction to the telegraph is just like the reaction to the internet. It fell into sort of three categories. On the one hand, there were people who thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, like Samuel Morse. And there were people who thought it would lead to world peace because international relations would be transformed because difficulties could be resolved very quickly. All that would happen is that heads of state would send each other a few telegrams and everything would be straightened out. This is what people thought. On the other hand, there were the complete skeptics who thought that the telegraph was affecting the weather and that it was over-reliance on a new and unreliable technology, which is what people say about the internet, and that it was just generally an evil, terrible thing, and that it made new forms of crime possible, for example. And so these crimes were blamed on the technology itself. Just as new forms of crime are blamed on the internet, when in fact we should be blaming the people who are actually carrying out these forms of crime. And then in the middle, there were the vast majority of people who were simply confused by the new technology, didn't know what to think of it one way or another. They didn't know how it worked. They didn't know what it would mean to them. And there were quite a lot of misconceptions floating around about it. So that was really the reaction as a whole. And as I say, it's very, very similar to what we see with the Telegraph.
Yeah.
Sorry, with the Internet today.
Yeah, very strong parallel. I like the grouping. That exactly explains how people respond today to the Internet. What about in terms of business practices? Today we talk about e-commerce. Was it telegraphic commerce? How did it
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people talk about information overload today, and they talk about how businesses must embrace the Internet or they're doomed. But I really don't have much sympathy for people who think that today's businessmen have an uphill struggle to get used to this, because the tidal wave that hit the businesses of the 1860s with the telegraph was really, frankly, much harder to get used to. If you look at how traders who dealt in things like tea and other things that were shipped around the world, if you looked at how they operated before the telegraph, they would write each other letters that would take weeks or months to arrive. And they would say, what's the price of tea this month or this year? And they'd get a letter a few weeks later, and then they'd write back and say, well, right, then I'll buy this much. And the whole process was incredibly slow-moving. And then almost overnight, with the construction of international cables, suddenly you could get prices all over the world in a single day, and you could have things like stock tickers that told you the price of gold, you know, by the second. And this meant that you really had no alternative but to act on this information, because if you didn't, your competitors would. And in fact, there's quite an amusing speech given in 1866 by a New York businessman who says exactly this. He says that, you know, the modern businessman is constantly on the jump. He hasn't got so much time to see his family, and he has no alternative. He must use the telegraph. So it really is exactly the same as what we see with businesses having to change their business practices completely now. In fact, I would say it was worse then than it is now, because we've had instant communications ever since the telegraph, and you can't get any faster than instant.
Not surprisingly, you comment in your book about news gathering, reflecting your background, I'm sure, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. What impact did it have for the news world?
Well, it meant that you could have information from all over the world. So you could give at least the illusion of a newspaper that tells you what's going on all over the world that day. And so newspapers were able to expand their coverage dramatically instead of just covering a local area. And if you look at how newspapers were put together before the telegraph, they were much more slow-moving things, and they would sometimes, you know, hold stories for a couple of weeks, you know, if they didn't have enough room, and then run them as news 2 weeks later. And it was all a totally different world. And then the telegraph comes along, and suddenly you can get news reports from all over the place. You can get them from across the Atlantic, and you can also do wonderful things like you can report an event of breaking news as it happens, and you can produce, say, four or five different editions of a newspaper during the day, reporting on this story that's going on, you know, thousands of miles away, and people will buy four editions of the newspaper, so you can increase your sales. So newspapers who were initially very scared of the telegraph, much as they were initially of the Internet, quickly realized that actually it was a great boon and that they would do very well out of it.
You mentioned earlier, made reference to new forms of crime. Can you give us maybe an example or two of that?
Yes. One of the problems with the telegraph initially was that it enabled you to exploit what you might call information imbalances. What this means is if I'm at a racetrack and I just see the result of a horse race, and I can telegraph the result to an accomplice, say at the other end of the country, faster than the bookmaker's accomplices can telegraph it to the bookmakers, then my accomplice could go and place a surefire bet on the result of the race, because the news won't have percolated through to the bookmaker where he goes. And so this was the sort of thing that people started doing. Similarly, they would pay people to delay the transmission of stock prices. And so forth. They would bribe telegraph operators. And this kind of thing happened almost immediately as soon as the telegraph was introduced. So what seems to happen is that whenever you have a new technology, you will always find people who find a way to exploit it. And what you must resist the temptation to do is to then blame this activity on the technology itself. Of course, this is exactly what we've seen with the Internet. There were also attempts to prevent this kind of thing from happening with codes. And, of course, wherever you have codes, you have some code breakers. And there were a series of battles between code breakers and governments who were trying to prevent people using codes. And, of course, that's exactly what we see on the Internet now as well.
That reminded me of the scene from The Sting, that idea of calling in horse races and whatever. That's an interesting phenomenon.
Exactly.
What about romances? You talk a little bit, and this really brings us close to some of the complaints about the use of the Internet, but how is romance a factor in the development of the telegraph?
Well, telegraphy was deemed to be a suitable work for women because it wasn't too strenuous. because you could sit down and just tap a key. And so by about 1870, a third of telegraphers were women. And they were segregated in the telegraph offices, and they had matrons to look after them and keep them away from their telegraphers, who were a rather rum bunch, by and large. And they were rather like the hacking community of today. They had their own customs and their own folklore and their own vocabulary, and no one else really knew what they were talking about. And even though they were physically segregated from the male telegraphers, they were, of course, in direct contact with them over the wires all day long. And inevitably, this led to friendships and quite a few romances and marriages. There were even online marriages in a couple of cases where the bride and groom were at opposite ends of the wires, or the bride and groom would be one end and the pastor would be at the other end. So all this sort of thing was going on in the 1870s. There was a book called The Dangers. There was a book called Wired Love. And there was a series of newspaper articles, one of which was called The Dangers of Wired Love, which warned about these sorts of things going on, and women would be running away from home and all this sort of thing. And so it's all exactly what we see on the internet today. And this just brings me back to the same theme, which is that when you see bad things happening as a result of something like the internet, you must remember not to blame the technology itself. It's just shooting the messenger. And that really is the point that I make. Well, I don't have to make it. The history speaks for itself, that we see so many of the same things happening, but what we're really seeing is human nature. We're not seeing the effects of the technology. We're just seeing it magnifying existing human tendencies, and that while technologies change, human nature stays the same.
Exactly, and you do make that point well. But let me just take you one more step here, again, picking up on what's happening today. Were there any attempts on the part of the government to control the use or to control crime and romance and whatever on the telegraph?
There weren't those sorts of attempts to control the telegraph network. What governments did try to do is prevent people, not so much government. Some governments made it illegal to send messages in code in some countries. And in Prussia, for example, for a while, copies of every telegram that was sent had to be kept so the government could look at them. So that's effectively, that is wiretapping. Similarly, the ITU, which now rules on how our modems should work, was actually set up initially to rule on how countries should connect their telegraph networks together. And the ITU tried unsuccessfully to prevent people from sending messages in code. And every time they changed the rules about what constituted a code, the code makers would come up with a new code to get around it. And there was a running battle to try and prevent this sort of thing from happening. But ultimately, the ITU gave up, and telegraphers were allowed to use whatever codes they wanted because it proved to be too difficult to stop them.
Again, that strikes a parallel. I sense the same kind of frustration today that whenever there's a movement toward control, they soon throw up their arms and say, but there's nothing we can do about it.
Quite.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, let me just take you back as we're nearing the end of about a minute left. The two points you make, and you make well, again, this is a dramatic impact, the telegraph. It's really quite revolutionary. And then secondly, your point about the parallels is certainly you've drawn those well in our talk here. What would you add to this in the last minute you have? What would you want to emphasize for our listeners?
Well, I'd want to say that however confusing you think the internet is, we should all thank our lucky stars we didn't have to get used to the telegraph, because that would have been a lot more confusing, I think, for the people at the time, because we've had telephones and things. And the second thing comes from exactly that, the telephone. The telegraph was ultimately replaced by the telephone, which was seen originally as merely a minor improvement. It was just thought to be a speaking telegraph. But of course, it turned out to be a completely new form of communication that ultimately prevailed. And I expect the same thing to happen to the internet. It's rather too telegraphic in its operation at the moment. You have to learn obscure codes, not quite as bad as Morse code, but it's a little bit difficult. So something out there, I hope, will transform it so that it's as easy to use as the telephone. And in the same way that the telegraph passed away and was replaced by something easier to use, I hope the same thing will happen to the internet.
Well, again, let me compliment your very fine book here. Certainly drawing these parallels between the telegraph and the internet will open some eyes and perhaps lend us a better understanding of what's happening. So
I hope so.
Great. Thank you again for being with us today, and again, congratulations on your new book.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Tom Standage, author of The Victorian Internet, The Remarkable Story of the Telegraph and the 19th Century's Online Pioneers, published by Walker & Company of New York. And this is Talking History. Native Americans are back in the news.
Their specific concerns have changed, but the larger issues of Indian-white relations seem the same. As a recent headline put it in reference to one tribe's attempts to profit from the tourist trade on its reservation, backlash growing as Indians make a stand for sovereignty. Here to give us some historical perspective on this latest Indian policy crisis is Bernard Weisberger. Weisberger is a freelance historical writer and consultant for both print media and television. He's a contributing editor for American Heritage magazine, and his op-ed is adapted from his column In the News, which appeared in the magazine's June 1999 issue.
There is trouble on the reservations. The headline news items last year tells how the tribal government of Montana's Crow Indians tried to share in the profits of the tourist trade on their reservation by laying a 4% tax on businesses catering to the sightseers who flocked to visit the scene of Custer's last stand. It's vital to the Crow people to have an independent source of income and, one might also think, a matter of belated justice, but not to the white owner of the Custer Battlefields Trading Company who's fighting the tax. "I didn't persecute anybody," he says. "We didn't do anything to them, and we don't owe them anything." It's one battle in a wider war over Indian control of reservation lands, which is guaranteed by treaties with the United States, treaties that take priority over state laws under the Constitution. But now, Wisconsin and Minnesota are in federal courts, challenging exclusive hunting and fishing rights guaranteed to their Indians. California wants to tax and regulate Indian-owned gambling casinos. Washington Senator Slade Gorton has proposed a bill to end altogether the treatment of Indian tribes as separate nations under Washington's protection. It's all part of a 1990s backlash against Indian sovereignty. Issues of state, property, and human rights are at stake. Do Native Americans have a special, historically earned entitlement to preserve their unique cultures? And if they are mainstream enough to run capitalistic businesses, shouldn't they follow the same rules as competing profit makers? It's nothing new. Those battling tribal governments were created under a 65-year-old law, the Wheeler-Howard Act of 1934, written when the country was in a different frame of mind. And that act, in turn, dramatically reversed the Dawes-Severalty Act of 1887. Wheeler-Howard aimed to preserve and strengthen tribal life on the reservation system. The Dawes Act was devised with the best of intentions to destroy them both. It was meant to atone for admitted wrongs to the Indians by helping them to become civilized out of their tribal togetherness. Each household would get an individual allotment of reservation land to farm, and in time, so-called savage ways would vanish. But in fact, it was the Indians who began to vanish as poverty and sickness among them continued to rise. That was the situation when John Codger took over in 1933 as Commissioner of Indian Affairs. Like many of his fellow New Deal appointees, he didn't believe that America's business civilization was the finest fruit of evolution. And he was a huge admirer of the way that Indians respected the earth and their collective identity and traditions. He called the Dawes Act a white land grab and a tragic move to divorce the Indian from his community. In the reform-friendly atmosphere of 1934, Collier got the policy-reshaping Wheeler-Howard measure through Congress. Besides providing concrete economic help, it authorized tribes to draft constitutions that set up machinery of self-government and of incorporation to carry on tribal economic enterprises, basically the system which, with a few changes, now exists. So here we are. The Dawes Act radiated the 1880s individualism and moral prescriptions for helping the downtrodden. Collier's Indian New Deal reflected the 1930s taste for folk culture and collective social planning. If the United States is headed for another overhaul of Indian policy and you want to make predictions, a look in the mirror of current social thinking is a good way to start.
You've been listening to Bernard Weisberger, freelance historical writer, consultant, and contributing editor of American Heritage magazine. This is Talking History. Turning to our recommended historic site of the week, we pick up on our conversation with Tom Standage and suggest that you visit his hometown and find out what makes it tick, if you'll excuse the expression. Here to make sense of that quip and to tell you about the historic sites in Mr. Standage's hometown is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Greenwich, England is the home of the Prime Meridian and was once the headquarters for royal astronomers in the 17th through 19th centuries. But Greenwich isn't all about time. Lately, it has become the epicenter for British millennial boosterism. In fact, from the highest rise in Greenwich Park, you can see the construction of Millennium Dome, what some have called a beacon to the world for the new millennium, and others have referred to in less than flattering terms. However, if that isn't your cup of tea or you plan to visit before the year 2000, there is the National Maritime Museum, an arts and crafts market that has been in the same site since 1849, the historic Queen House, and a dry dock clipper ship, and much more to keep many a visitor entertained.
Thank you, Cindy. Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, Kingsville, Maine may be best known for downhill skiing, but it has its place in history as well. It's the birthplace of F.E. and F.O. Stanley, the identical twins who gave us the Stanley Steamer Automobile. 1999 marks the 100th anniversary of one of the early steamers' journey over a bumpy road and past sheer drop-offs to the top of the 6,000-foot Mount Washington in New Hampshire. Owners of the remaining Stanley steamers from California to England are gearing up to recreate that ride on August 31st. If you decide to witness the hill climb firsthand, be sure to visit Kingsville Stanley Museum, home to restored steamers and many other Stanley Brothers inventions. For further information, contact the Stanley Museum in Kingsville, Maine. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we talk about the nature of historical fiction with Kevin Baker, author of the historical novel Dreamland. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I got the day.